From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Saudi Arabia has a new leader after the death of King Abdullah, who ruled for the past two decades. We begin with this report from RT's Matt Treza.
The King of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz, died early Friday at the age of 90. Abdullah was born in 1924. He ascended to the throne in 2005. He was named the eighth most powerful person by Forbes magazine. Personal wealth estimated at $17 billion. He's also known for having at least 11 wives and 16 children, though there is no official confirmation of the exact number. His reign was viewed both positively and negatively. For example, he strengthened the country's economy and conducted a meeting on interfaith dialogue with the Pope. During the Arab Spring, he tried to improve social programs and gave women the right to vote. Meanwhile, he is, though, accused of destabilizing Iran and ruling violently in his own country. The torture of inmates, public beheadings, imprisoning of social activists happened regularly during his reign. To discuss the future of the Saudi kingdom after the death of King Abdullah, I'm joined by author and historian Gerald Horn. So what legacy does King Abdullah leave behind?
A checkered legacy at best. First of all, he was very close to the United States, very close to former U.S. President George W. Bush. But yet, despite his closeness to Washington, he was not able to get Washington to get behind his so-called Saudi peace plan that was supposed to pressure Israel to trade land for peace. Secondly, his violations of civil liberties at home, the floggings, the beheadings, the prevention of women from driving cars, and all the rest. Then he faces a very serious problem as we speak, that is to say Saudi Arabia does, and neighboring Yemen. Just within the last 24 hours, the leadership of that country has resigned. The leadership had been close to Saudi Arabia. They will probably be replaced by forces close to Iran, which will further complicate Saudi national security.
Do you have any bead whatsoever on the now King Salman, former Crown Prince Salman, who has assumed the throne?
Prince Salman also has health problems. I don't expect him to be in the land of the living too much longer, quite frankly. And that will probably unleash a battle royal amongst the various princes, of which there are many in Saudi Arabia. Secondly, Prince Salman, during his heyday, was the point man with regard to funding the Mujahideen, so-called, in the 1980s in Afghanistan. He has also been close to the Wahhabi clerical establishment that is ultra-reactionary and plays a destabilizing role in all of the neighboring countries.
So how will the opposition in Saudi Arabia react to his death? Do you think there will be protests or any unrest?
Well, as you know, in the oil-producing regions of Saudi Arabia, there is a substantial Shia minority. As you know, Saudi Arabia is a predominantly Sunni Muslim country. There has been restiveness in those oil-producing countries. In any event, because of the fall in the price of a barrel of oil, the budget of Saudi Arabia has been quite constrained, helping to contribute to skyrocketing and spiraling unemployment, particularly amongst the youth. I expect those problems to continue, if not worsen.
So we've mentioned Saudi Arabia's criticism for its human rights record. Do you think there are any changes in that respect in the pipeline?
Well, I think it depends upon the restiveness, particularly in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia. I also think it depends upon the developing relationship with Iran. I think that with the instability in Saudi Arabia, with the passing of the king, there will be a distinct possibility that Iran will get the upper hand in that relationship. That could put destabilizing pressure on Saudi Arabia and actually could lead to an improvement in the internal situation.
Now, we've been talking about the oil prices that's been mentioned. How do you think Abdullah's death may affect those? They have been rising recently. Of course, Saudi Arabia has its policy of not cutting production at the moment. Do you think that could change?
Well, it's very interesting, this fall of the price of oil. On the one hand, there's been this argument that has been engineered by the Saudis in part to help to ruin Iran, in part to help to inflict wounds on Russia in league with Washington, and also tailing after Washington to inflict wounds upon countries like Venezuela on the northern coast of South America. On the other hand, there is an argument that the fall in the price of oil has been engineered by Saudi Arabia to hurt the United States because it will put a cramp in the United States' ability to move to alternative sources of energy beyond petroleum. I'm speaking of wind and solar in particular. On the other hand, there is an argument that it's the United States that's the culprit, that with the so-called shale oil boom and the desire to bring tar sands oil from Canada, that the United States has flooded the market with petroleum and therefore is helping to bring down the price of oil for purposes akin to those I've just enunciated, that is to say, to hurt Russia, to hurt Iran, and to hurt Venezuela. So it's unclear what role Saudi Arabia has played in the fall of the price of oil.
What changes do you think, if any, there could be in the internal politics of the Gulf region?
Well, hopefully it will lead to a curtailing of Saudi Arabia's ability to interfere in the internal affairs of its neighbors. I'm thinking of Lebanon in the first place, where it has been involved in a de facto hot war, if not cold war, with Hezbollah, which is a major player in Lebanese politics. Saudi Arabia needs to
strong,
tread
and
very
Hezbollah, which is strongly backed by Iran.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia has to tread very carefully, however. You know that in recent days and weeks on the Saudi borders, there have been attacks by so-called ISIS forces, the so-called Islamic State forces. I dare say that ISIS, which has established quite a foothold in Iraq and thanks to the United States in Syria as well, might be looking greedily upon making overtures and inroads into Saudi Arabia with this present instability brought by the death of the king.
And finally, what changes, if any, do you expect in ties between Saudi Arabia and the U.S.?
In the short term, not that much, but you should know that there are fundamental contradictions between Saudi Arabia and the United States. I was very struck by the fact that in recent days there has been unusual U.S. criticism of the Saudi whipping of a dissident blogger. That just does not happen. You have had human rights groups in the United States also criticizing Saudi Arabia in recent days and weeks. That usually does not happen either. The whole question of whether or not the Saudis are driving down the price of oil is also a factor, because I'm speaking to you from the state of Texas, and I can bring you firsthand evidence that the fall in the price of oil is wrecking the budget of the state of Texas. It's driving businesses into bankruptcies. It's harming banks. It's ruining real estate. And there are a lot of people in the state of Texas who are very angry with Saudi Arabia, blaming them for the fall in the price of oil.
All right. Author and historian Gerald Horn, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The king will be succeeded by his younger half-brother, Salman bin Abdulaziz, who was born in 1935. He is reported to be the 25th son of King Abdulaziz. He served as Minister of Defense from 2011. He took over monarchy responsibilities this month. Before becoming defense minister, he governed Riyadh province since 1963. Now 79 years old, he's reportedly suffering from Alzheimer's disease.
Despite having at least a dozen wives and presiding over a country where women are forbidden to drive, Christine Lagarde, the head of the International Monetary Fund, called Abdullah a feminist. She was quoted in the Guardian newspaper as saying, quote, in a very discreet way, he was a strong advocate of women. It was very gradual, appropriately so probably for the country. I discussed that issue with him several times, and he was a strong believer, closed quote. And despite strong evidence that Saudi Arabia has been one of the driving forces behind the spread of terrorism throughout the Middle East and beyond, including the training and funding of terrorist groups in Syria, Libya, and elsewhere, the UN Secretary General praised his legacy as a peacemaker. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia left a tangible legacy that can still point the way towards peace in the Middle East. according to the UN Secretary General. Ban Ki-moon said the king, who died on Thursday at the age of 90, was a driving force behind the Arab Peace Initiative. King Abdullah, he said, made major contributions to the development of his kingdom, such as achieving remarkable progress and prosperity for its people. The UN chief also paid tribute to his efforts to promote dialogue among the world's faiths. He added that the king's leadership will be remembered throughout the Arab and Islamic worlds and the international community. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
President Barack Obama, who's been critical of the human rights records of many leaders around the world and has taken military action against some, such as Libya, for alleged human rights violations, issued the following statement from the White House. Quote, "It is with deep respect that I express my personal condolences and the sympathies of the American people to the family of King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz and to the people of Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah's life spanned from before the birth of modern Saudi Arabia through its emergence as a critical force within the global economy and a leader among Arab and Islamic nations. He took bold steps in advancing the Arab Peace Initiative, an endeavor that will outlive him as an enduring contribution to the search for peace in the region. At home, King Abdullah's vision was dedicated to the education of his people and to greater engagement with the world. As our countries worked together to confront many challenges, I always valued King Abdullah's perspective and appreciated our genuine and warm friendship. As a leader, he was always candid and had the courage of his convictions. One of those convictions was his steadfast and passionate belief in the importance of the U.S.-Saudi relationship as a force for stability and security in the Middle East and beyond. The closeness and strength of the partnership between our two countries is part of King Abdullah's legacy. May God grant him peace," closed quote. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, another Western leader who went to war over claims of human rights violations, had this to say about the late Saudi monarch.
"I think we will miss King Abdullah hugely. He was a force for stability in his country. He was a great advocate of better relations between the East and the West. He stood out against the extremists and their ideology. He was a modernizer. He made the first moves towards more equal treatment for men and women in Saudi Arabia. And he was a staunch advocate of the Arab Peace Initiative, in fact launched it, to bring about peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So I think we will miss him very greatly."
Meanwhile, Greece may be getting a new government, with elections set for this Sunday, and the left opposition party Syriza poised to take power on a promise to end the austerity imposed on its people by the EU, European Central Bank, and IMF. We have this report from Press TV.
Tens of thousands of Greeks have taken to the streets of Athens to show their support for opposition party Syriza. Demonstrators say they are determined to oust the conservative New Democracy Party in favor of the anti-austerity Syriza. In an address to protesters, the leader of the leftist party, Alexis Tsipras, promised to put aside traditional parties that have ruled Greece for four decades.
"We want to assure you, we will not hesitate, we won't get scared, and we won't turn back as many hurdles and as many difficulties we will face in front of us. We're reaching closer to the end of the pre-election period, and Mr. Samaras and his far-right company day by day sink in a crescendo of alarmism, fear and lies. We have a plan, and we pledge to refuse the guardianship from wherever it comes from, to finish with the memorandums and to negotiate hard with the sole interest of our people."
Syriza is leading opinion polls and its leader is almost certain to win Sunday's vote. Greece has seen 6 years of tough austerity measures imposed by its international creditors in exchange for billions in bailout aid. The deep recession left nearly a third of the population living at or below the poverty line and 26% of Greeks unemployed. To get the latest on that, we're now joined by Konstantin Venizelos, Press TV's correspondent, who's joining us from the Greek capital. Konstantin, a lot of confidence on the part of Syriza here.
"Well, I think we should keep from this evening's speech by the leader of Syriza is when people looked up in awe the moment he said that his party, if elected this coming Sunday into office, will go ahead against the EU policy, the way the European financial policy stands at the moment. And he said that the party is ready for a head-on collision with the EU. And that was rather clear and decisive. And it was the first time Mr. Tsipras was so adamant and precise when he said, I repeat, that the party is ready for a head-on collision with the EU and its current financial policies of pro-austerity programs and wage and pension cuts and the gradual privatization of Greece's welfare, healthcare and education systems. So I think the systemic challenges for Syriza will be great and many from the first day it will be elected into power. And of course, these will come from both within Greece and of course from European banks that hold mass amounts of the Greek state bonds. Syriza will have to make small repayments for the first 6 months when elected into power. And at the moment, the way the state budget stands, there literally is very little money in the Greek state coffers. So Syriza will have to find a way to come up with some cash as soon as the first month from when it takes power in Greece. Therefore, it will be an uphill struggle, Wakar, for Syriza from the first week. And we'll see how these scenarios of the Grexit and Greece being kicked out of the Eurozone play out when we know, of course, who the finance minister will be. And we will be following this down to the minute, of course, and we will keep you posted for any developments as they happen. But at the moment, it comes across that Syriza is very decisively against EU financial policies, the way these are applied in Spain, in Greece, in Italy, and in Portugal.
Fighting continues to rage in the eastern part of Ukraine, where, according to Rupert Colville, a spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, more than 260 people have reportedly been killed in the past 9 days, with the total death toll from fighting since the summer now over 5,000.
The significant escalation of hostilities in Ukraine since the 13th of January has taken the total death toll in the country to at least 5,086 individuals, and we fear that the real figure may be considerably higher. In just 9 days, between the 13th and 21st of January, at least 262 people were killed due to the hostilities. This is an average of at least 29 people per day. And this is the most deadly period since the declaration of a ceasefire on the 5th of September.
We have more from RT's Roman Kasarev, who was in Donetsk late Friday and filed this report.
Well, artillery fire and shooting and cannonade continued throughout this Friday. And moreover, three residential areas here in Donetsk were also shelled Thursday going on Friday during the night. And as a result of that, one civilian had been killed. Of course, this is also on the back of the fact that the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, when he met with his military council, he said that he's going to add more reserves to the southeast of Ukraine, and he also said that if any of the anti-government fighters continue to fight, then he will, quote, strike them in the teeth. All the meanwhile, the anti-government fighters are accusing Kyiv of using heavy artillery in shelling off its territory. Anti-government forces are also saying that at this point there is really no point of carrying out, continuing with the peace talks. And they also said that there are scores of bodies of Ukrainian soldiers that are in their possession, and that officials in Kyiv are refusing to pick up those bodies. the head of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, Alexander Zakharchenko, appealed to the relatives of the soldiers that were killed here, and he promised them full security if they decide to come here and pick up those bodies. Of course, the civilian death count continues to grow here in the east of Ukraine. 15 people had been killed as a result of a mortar attack in the city of Donetsk, the capital of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. And today and in the days to come, there will be mourning as people continue bringing flowers to the scene of the tragedy.
One of the most powerful figures in the history of New York's state government faces a possible long term in prison. Federal authorities announcing the arrest Thursday of Sheldon Silver, the Speaker of the New York State Assembly since 1994 on a sweeping series of corruption charges, said he exploited his position as one of the most powerful politicians in the state to obtain millions of dollars in bribes and kickbacks. Silver, a Democrat from the Lower East Side of Manhattan, was accused of steering state real estate developers to a law firm that paid him kickbacks. He was also accused of funneling state grants to a doctor who referred asbestos claims to a second law firm that employed Silver and paid him fees for referring clients. Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District, announced the indictments at a press conference Thursday. Speaking Friday at the New York Law School, Bharara took direct aim at how deal-making has long been done in Albany, challenging the three-men-in-a-room scenario that defined Silver's reign, with the governor, the Speaker of the Assembly, and the President of the Senate working in secret and without accountability to decide most vital issues among themselves. Charles Barron is one of the newest members of the New York State Assembly. He began his first term there earlier this month after serving a long stint in the New York City Council. We spoke with him by telephone from Albany Friday.
It means a couple of things. One, it gives us an opportunity. As you know, I didn't vote for Mr. Silver before he was arrested. I said no, and not only do I believe he should step down, I didn't even think he should have stepped up in the first place. It's time for new leadership in Albany. Now, this provides us, I think, with an opportunity to really look at some serious reform, how you take some power away from the Speaker and empower more of the members of the Senate and the members of the Assembly. It's also an opportunity for us to look at this insulting concept of three men in the room determining a $141 billion budget for over 18, 19 million people in the state of New York with over 150 assembly people and 63 senators. These three men in the room, only two of them have a vote on the budget. One doesn't even have a vote on the budget. The other two have one vote, and yet they have all this power. Something's fundamentally wrong with a so-called democracy that has that much power in the hands of three people. So I'm going to use this as an opportunity to say to my colleagues in the Assembly, this is your chance to stand up on principles, stand up for the people of the state, and say that we have the power to pass the budget and pass laws, not the governor, not one member of the Assembly, the Speaker, not one member of the Senate, Skelos, the pro tem or president of the Senate, not one. They have one vote. We have 149 votes in the Assembly minus one, and they have 62 votes in the Senate minus one. Now, I'm a realist. I do understand that the people in the Senate and the members in the Assembly and the Senate don't feel empowered. They are afraid. They are forcibly, I think, loyal. And they are using that power that they assume that they have, the three men in the room, to whip people in line, punish those who step out of line, and reward those who step in line. So I think this is an opportunity to reform that and change that and look at the priorities in this state, and that is as we move toward the budget process and some serious legislation that has to be passed.
What kind of controls in the day-to-day operation of the Assembly in terms of the major stuff does the Speaker have over the operations?
Well, you know, I've been fortunate to have the experience of dealing with a powerful Speaker, two different powerful Speakers in the City Council in New York City. I've been in there for 12 years, and that is Speaker Miller and Speaker Christine Quinn. And like the speakers and the leaders of the Senate and the House on the congressional level, the speaker determines how much capital and programmatic money that you're going to get for your district. The speaker determines what committees you're going to serve on and chair. The speaker determines what, if your legislation is going to die in committee and or see the light of the day and hit the floor for a vote. So when you empower the speaker with all of that, then you get members who know if they don't go along with the speaker, they get punished. And if they do, they get some kind of rewards. And this punishing and reward system is what was keeping them disempowered. So as I did in the city council, it took me 12 years to achieve it, but we started the Fresh Democracy Council when I first came in 2002 in the city council with 26 new members because of term limits. And we laid out some rules that would give more power to the members. And I'm very pleased to say that the year I left, now there's an equitable distribution of capital money on a needs-based formula, and the same thing for programmatic money. So the speaker does not have the discretion to determine how much capital and program money are given out to members. That's on a needs-based formula and equitable basis. The similar thing has to happen up here in the State Assembly. The speaker should be a facilitator, not a dictator.
And we close with this commentary from Black Agenda Radio's Bruce Dixon on the subject of Charlie Hebdo.
If you actually want to understand why some fraction of Muslims saw gratuitous insult instead of satire when the French magazine Charlie Hebdo depicted the Prophet Muhammad doing things you would not want your own small children to see, or depicting pregnant Muslims as Boko Haram sex slaves howling for their welfare checks, all you've got to do is look at two bits of history. Philosopher Karen Armstrong, in her latest book, Religion and Political Violence, goes a long way to break it down. The first bit of history, Armstrong explains, is that the notion of religion as a set of practices and beliefs about the deity, which you can perform on Sundays, separate from how you put together political and economic life, is an exclusively Western concept that nobody on earth before 17th and 18th century Europeans would recognize at all. The Sanskrit, Jewish, Arabic, and other old world terms for religion all mean something that recognizes no separation between politics, economics, and morality and moral life. It took more than a century of warfare in the 16 and 1700s at a cost of hundreds of thousands of European lives in order to establish that kind of religion in Europe which could be separated from politics and economics. That way, European elites could have slavery and capitalism. European rulers could exterminate tens of millions in history's greatest genocide colonizing the New World and still call themselves Christians. Non-European Muslims are being allowed only a generation or two, and fortunately a lot less bloodshed, to make that kind of transition, which brings us to Armstrong's second bit of relevant history. She reminds us that the 20th century's so-called modernizers in the Muslim world mostly did not do it with friendly and democratic persuasion. Under the approving eyes of the West, they did it forcibly, with secret police, torture, discriminatory laws, kangaroo courts, and especially in Iran, sponsored by Britain and the U.S., with bullets fired into crowds of often nonviolent protesters. In addition to needed reforms, like curtailing Sharia law, Turkey's Kemal Ataturk, the Pahlavis in Iran, and Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser each locked up sometimes thousands of religious opponents and purged them from the civil service and political life. This ain't exactly how you train people to engage in a friendly, respectful, and civil discussion of religious and political differences. It is how you make lasting enemies, enemies ready and alert for the next slight or insult. But this is the real and relevant history Americans have trained themselves not to know. Add to this the wave of armed U.S. and European interventions in Muslim lands, our puppet governments, our occupations, our torture campaigns and drone strikes, and factor in that even while cruise missile liberals like Bill Maher and U.S. presidents say we just don't do religious war, U.S. military personnel, at the tip of the spear, as they say, call their enemies Hajis, and police departments in the U.S. and Europe surveil Muslim communities wholesale and incarcerate Muslims disproportionately. In this context, unlike jokes exposing the foibles of the powerful, which are real satire, Charlie Hebdo, which is now subsidized by the French government, is engaged in something much like war propaganda. And Bill Maher is just another cruise missile liberal, a bully. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.